And now, I would love to introduce Julie Schaefer, Head of Strategic Philanthropy and Purpose Investments from Bank of the West, who will introduce our speakers tonight.
Hey, hi everyone. It's great to see some familiar faces here tonight. As I was already introduced, Julie Schaefer, I'm Head of Strategic Philanthropy and Purpose Investments for BNP Paribas, Bank of the West. As some of you probably know, BNP is our parent company. It's the fifth largest private bank in the world, headquartered in Paris. And Bank of the West, obviously, headquartered here in San Francisco. So we really have the best of both worlds. We do global, we do local. And we're happy about these two sides of our expertise. And tonight, we really welcome our partnership with another great expert, the Commonwealth Club and Inforum. We're very, very happy to be here, and we're honored to support the great programs and conversations like this that really reflect our concerns as a financial institution. And I know these topics certainly affect our communities and our country and certainly our world. My team, the Strategic Philanthropy and Purpose Investment Team, we really work with donors and investors, helping them find ways to be most efficient with their giving and to be most effective with their investment. And we look at those two as very important combinations, and we look to amplify investment and look to amplify philanthropy with what we do. So I'm pleased to introduce tonight's speakers. David Banks is the editor of ImpactAlpha.com, which, as you probably know, provides investment news with a sustainable edge. His company, Impact Alpha, also includes ImpactSpace.org. It's an open database of impact companies, investors, and people. Prior to Impact Alpha, David led Civic Ventures and Encore.org, and spent many years as a journalist covering Silicon Valley and emerging philanthropy at a variety of outlets. And tonight's featured speaker, Nancy Fund, who I consider just a rock star in the space. Nancy is the founder and managing partner of DBL Partners, a venture capital firm with a pioneering double bottom line investment strategy that's paved the way for the world of impact investing by demonstrating the power of venture capital to promote and advance social change. So what's the first bottom line? It's top-tier financial returns, similar to other VCs. The second bottom line, which is the differentiator, where Nancy and her team really shine, is that DBL Partners works closely with their portfolio companies to ensure that they enable social, economic, and/or environmental improvements in the places that they work or operate. So I bet you've heard about some of these companies: Tesla, SolarCity, Revolution Foods, Mapbox, SpaceX, The RealReal, and many others in sectors of clean tech, healthcare, information technology, sustainable products and services. Prior to DBL Partners, Nancy was managing director of capital at JP Morgan, which helped launch the Bay Area Equity Fund that eventually spun off into DBL Partners. Nancy sits on the board of companies like The Muse and Primus Power, as well as on numerous academic and advisory councils, speaks and publishes widely, and has been a groundbreaker in the impact investing world setting for many, many others to follow her path. So we're looking forward to this conversation with Nancy and David, and we welcome them to the stage. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. I'm David Bank, and I'm the editor of Impact Alpha, as you saw. I'm thrilled to be here in conversation with Nancy to talk about all things impact investment. I'm an old-time newspaper beat reporter, including at the Wall Street Journal, and a few years ago I got onto what I thought was a very big story, namely the transformation of private capital markets around the creation of social and environmental value, which is kind of a mouthful, so it came to be called impact investing as a shorthand. We launched Impact Alpha a couple years ago. We'd like to say we were covering impact investing as if it were a beat, in the expectation that it would indeed become one, which in fact it has. So much of a beat that earlier this year we went daily with our daily newsletter, email newsletter called The Brief, which you can get if you go to impactalpha.com/thebrief. And beat coverage means follow the money in the classic tradition, and it also means follow the leaders, which is a great way to both of those lead straight to Nancy, who I've been following for several years, and it's great to meet up again.
Great to be here.
Let's just get a little sense of who's here, so we'll sort of know what level to pitch it. I mean, first of all, who knows what impact investing is? All right, that's a good start. Who considers themselves an investor? Who considers themselves an entrepreneur? Who considers themselves a sort of advocate or activist or an intermediary that making stuff happen? And who is sort of other and maybe shout out what that other is if in a word or two. There's no others. Okay. Oh, there's another. A corporate leader. Okay, excellent. So now we can get rolling.
Now we know who's here.
Yeah, yeah. I want to get one thing out of the way first, because everybody thinks about it and nobody asks it, which is your name. You manage a fund, and your name is Fund.
born for this job, I guess.
So where does that name come from?
Well, it's spelled with a P, so it's not exactly the same as the funds we manage. It's a German word. It means pound. It's actually more of a Swiss name, which is where my father's family came from.
And how do you pronounce it?
The P is silent. So it is.
So it is fun.
A fund. Yeah.
Okay. So we have fund and we have bank. So we are. and we have a bank. So when I was at the Wall Street Journal, the editors loved it when I got the sort of bank earnings roundup, because then on the story skit it would say banks by bank. So we actually have a guy on our team named Dennis Price. So we have fund and bank and Price. You're a venture capitalist. Even before DBL, you were a VC in the tech space. When you were little, did you say, I want to grow up and be a venture capitalist?
Hardly. I didn't even know what a venture capitalist was, frankly. It was not as much of a thing when I was growing up. And I was a humanities and social science kind of student and never, ever dreamed that I would even want to work in finance, let alone make it my full career.
So tell us how the twists and turns.
Well, it all had to do, I have had a love for innovation and technology. My father was a patent attorney and an inventor, and I have four sisters, and we were always either his manufacturing team or marketing staff. And so that's always been with me, the love of entrepreneurship. So I went to work at Intel when I started after business school. But happily, I got engaged, and I see my husband and daughter here in the audience tonight. So I needed to move to the city because we were going to live in the East Bay, and even back then, traffic was terrible. So back then, it's hard to believe, but there were no jobs, tech jobs, in San Francisco. So I said, okay, I got to switch to finance because there are finance jobs in San Francisco. And I was lucky enough to find Hamburg & Quist, where I would have worked for my entire life had we not been acquired. I worked there for some 24 years, and that was one of the leading venture capital and investment banks banking the Valley before Wall Street discovered it.
So you've been through various booms and busts over the course of those decades.
Too many to count, I'm afraid.
we'll get to that in a minute. But at some point at J.P. Morgan, you and Julie called this out. You formed something called the Bay Area Equity Fund. Were you? I mean, which was an early impact fund. Mm-hmm, where did the impact part of that? How did your story lead you to?
Well,
impact?
It's a great story. It's a great Bay Area story because it was really a blending of the financial and business community with a regional community groups and the Bay Area Council. And I know Lenny Mendonca is here somewhere who was there at the creation. Thanks for coming. So basically back then in the sort of 2000 period, there was dissatisfaction that all the benefits of the most recent internet boom were not distributed broadly across the region. You know, Richmond wasn't getting those jobs. Oakland back then was not getting tech jobs. And so the Bay Area Council worked with community groups and banks in our region to say, let's pay attention to place. What might happen if we try to site entrepreneurial companies in areas of the Bay that are lower income? And so that was really the first iteration of what became DBL and has really blossomed to include many more impact measures. But it really started with that simple idea that you can bring the benefits of the entrepreneurial economy to neighborhoods that really need jobs, that need economic vitality. And once you do that, a lot of good things start to happen. So it was a public-private partnership.
And at the time, the concept wasn't as widely known, and certainly the sort of investor interest was not what it is now. And it was tough to raise that. I mean,
it was brutal. It was not only was that sort of the dot-com demise had already happened, and no one wanted to hear anything about venture capital. Yeah, vanilla venture capital, let alone this sort of do-gooder venture capital that we were espousing. And so it was tough, and we had a hard time convincing people because there was no precedent. It's not like we had done this before. And people thought that mixing financial and social goals would result in lower financial returns. It's pretty much what the bias was. But we persevered. We had the help of the Bay Area Council. The banks were very receptive to us. Although we had a gentleman working with us once, we just would not listen to no. And he just kept knocking on the door of a bank that ended up not joining us. And one day I got actually a cease and desist letter from that. I realized that perhaps this was going to be more difficult than we thought. But we made our target. It was a very small fund. It was $75 million. But we made it and then started to really be creative and figure out how to do this thing.
And then your latest fund, I think, was quite a bit larger and also maybe somewhat easier.
Well, I will never say easy, and my partner, Aaron Price, is here to attest that while it was much more straightforward than the past, you know, there's always something that people are going to ask you questions about or ways that they show resistance. But the good news is that, yes, we raised a $400 million fund, which was more than we thought we would do, we being the DBL team, which I'm so grateful so many of you are here tonight. And basically, we're able to show that this is moving into the mainstream. It's not a boutique. It's not just marginal dollars. This is getting to be a very sizable fund, $400 million. And as Julie talked about, we now have a whole industry that's doing this. So what a difference, you know, 10 or 12 years makes.
Right. But let's like just do a sort of level set of like, so you call yourself an impact investor, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
Proudly.
We do, although that term did not exist when we started. So it's something that we've adopted.
Some people, you know, that's the sort of conversation we get into. Some people run towards it. Some people run away from it.
Yeah.
but how do you define it? What makes you an impact investor?
Well, intentionality is a big part of it. It isn't just that you finance a company and it happens to do some great things for the planet. I mean, basically all investing has an impact. It's whether you define it, you nurture it, and you optimize it that makes a difference. And so we believe that impact investing has a role not only in terms of your intention, but also in the way that you measure your outcomes. And so when you put those two together, then you're really able to tell, you know, are we making money? Are we reducing our carbon footprint? Are we improving nutrition for kids? I mean, there's a whole, are we improving low-income neighborhoods by putting successful companies there? There's a whole way, the good news about impact investing is it's a big tent. It really allows you to focus on social outcomes that are important to you and that you're good at the same time that you're driving that financial return. Because when all is said and done, we always feel that the first bottom line has to come first, because if you're not if you don't have a successful company, then you're really not able to have a huge impact. I mean, sort of by definition. And so everyone always asks, well, which one do you put more weight on? And it really has to be the first. But the good news is that the second can be enhanced, and it can end up improving the outcome, improving the financial outcome by differentiating your companies in a variety of ways.
I mean, you've been sort of on this point, sort of holding forth on that very point for a while. And as you say, there's a range of opinions about that. But like the first fund, as you said, was tough to raise because people thought there might be a concession or a trade-off, as people call it. I think the third fund now, you're pretty clear and convincing that there's not a trade-off.
Very definitely. Now we have some case studies. I mean, it doesn't hurt to have a company like Tesla or SolarCity or Pandora that become household names and have made very strong financial returns and yet are changing the world for the better. Having those examples is key. At the same time, today's entrepreneurs are all in for impact. I mean, it's so different than when we started, where we kind of had to explain to a lot of folks, we're going to be traditional venture capitalists, but we're going to help you have a broader impact and have a positive impact on society, not just on Wall Street. Today's entrepreneurs really want it all. They want to have a big successful exit with a high profile company, but they want to change the world for the better in the way that they can figure that out, in the way in which they can excel. And so that makes our job a lot easier than it used to be.
They want that because of their own values, or they want that because of some business advantage they might get, retention and recruitment?
Both. I think that, I mean, the entrepreneur has sort of an outsized personality by definition. And, when you take on incumbents and start your own company, you have to have a pretty good sense of self in order to fight those battles. So if you tell an entrepreneur, well, you can not only have a great company and be famous, but you can actually make a lasting impact on society or on the climate or, fill in the blank, that psychologically appeals to entrepreneurs. And so as we've seen examples of the leaders of this first generation of companies, I think that the next gen are saying, gee, I want to do what that person did.
So to the extent when people, the thing that people do know about DBL, to the extent that it's sort of publicly known, is Tesla is sort of the original marquee company. How were you an early investor? I think how early and how good a deal has that been for you guys?
Sure. Well, it was it in 2006? Thank you, Mark. Which was the first institutional round that Tesla had. There had been a few rounds before, the friends and family. Of course, Elon Musk was one of the original seed investors. So in 2006 is when the company took in institutional money, meaning from venture capital firms as opposed to angels and family and friends. And it's hard to understand today because Tesla has become such a huge brand and force of positive change globally, but back then it was very controversial. People laughed at us. They shook their heads and just wondered what on earth were we thinking. So it was a pretty difficult ride. And as those of you that have followed Tesla, there were several times when it wasn't clear the company would make it, when the obstacles were too great. Obviously, 2008, the crash, the bailout of the auto industry, all of that. It was very difficult to raise money in the early days. And so those are the kinds of deals that, of course, deliver the return that you never dreamed of when all is said and done many years later, but they really do give you that fortitude to realize that when you go through tough patches, when things are difficult, you know, that isn't anomalous. That is kind of what our work is about, and getting through those periods can lead to the kinds of breakthroughs that Tesla exemplifies.
So in those early days, you know, how much of this sort of grand plan was either in place in Elon Musk's head or in your own thinking between the sort of trifecta of electric vehicles as well as solar, as well as batteries? I mean, was that something that you said, oh, that's the future, we want to be part of that?
Well, in the beginning, it was a car company. It was an electric car company, and that's what, you know, if you read our investment memo from back then, I don't think there's a mention of stationary storage. That came very soon after the investment, but really the fundamental decision was as a mission investor, we wanted to see, can we unhinge transportation from fossil fuel? Because transportation globally is a huge bad actor in terms of creating carbon, and so we need to do something about that, and electric vehicles are a wonderful way to do that. So that was what we invested in. That has always been the mission of Tesla, and not just to develop its own products, but to change the industry and get all people eventually to buy electric. So that was the mission, and very soon afterwards, we had actually invested in a solar company called Powerlight, which was eventually sold to SunPower, one of the early pioneers in solar. And so we were already believers in solar, but bringing those together took many years. But the investment in SolarCity was part of the plan in terms of once you buy an electric car, you feel great, and then you're like, well, what, you know, I'm not going to the gas pump, so I'm obviously not using gas, but what am I using? What is powering that my electricity? So they're very synergistic, because you say, well, if I have an electric car, I'd love for it to run clean. Gee, one way for it to run clean is to have solar panels on my house. So there's a big aha moment for a lot of EV drivers, and so they do cross-sell very well. But of course, that was not in our mind back then. Right. It was that came later.
Well, so the ramp on electric vehicles is pretty remarkable. The ramp on solar is absolutely staggering. But the third part of it, which you called it stationary storage, which I think most people call batteries, right? Mm-hmm. is also remarkable now, right? I mean, the price of lithium ion batteries, which is what the Powerwall has been falling. You know, I was just looking back at our coverage in January. We said it had fallen below $350 per kilowatt hour, and then I see Elon Musk is tweeting to Australia that he's going to do it for $250, and it might even fall, you know, further than that. You smile at your friend because, like, you're saying, why did he actually tweet that?
Well, I'm smiling because Elizabeth Brinton here, who used to work with SMUD and PG&E, and is a longtime San Franciscan, is now living in Australia and trying to help that country through the company she works at, AGL, go solar and develop a renewable energy profile.
And put in a lot of batteries, I guess, right?
And offer the 100-day ready site.
Okay.
So little did you know that news is being made on this stage as we speak.
Were you guys all surprised to see the tweet storm that led to that?
Well, I think people that follow Elon Musk are never surprised by anything he tweets. I mean, that's sort of his way. But definitely storage is the future. I mean, the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow, and so any time that you can take a variable resource and turn it into baseload, which storage enables by storing that electricity that comes from your panels or from other renewable sources, you have enabled a distributed clean grid. And that's really what we need to make a big difference in carbon worldwide. And the good news is it's very transportable. We're going to see, just as some of the developing nations, Africa, for example, went straight to cell phone, you know, kind of skipped the landline generation. There are nations in Africa and other developing parts of the world that will skip the centralized, dirty fossil plant and move straight to solar and storage. So that's something, a lesson that we're learning and being able to maximize that savings and really allow a whole part of the world that hasn't even had electricity to benefit from starting clean. We have a company called Off-Grid Electric that's doing this, kind of taking those learnings that we've had in this country and bringing them to Africa.
Well, so here's a question, because solar is so hot, as you said, the adoption rates are huge. I made some notes. 15 gigawatts installed in 2016 of solar, nearly double 2015. Solar was the country's number one source of new electrical generating capacity. 260,000 people, Americans, now employed in the solar industry, up 25%. So solar is very hot, yet there's headlines now of all the solar companies. You know, Sungevity just declared bankruptcy, SunPower has been in trouble, you know, Solar City itself, you know, was in some trouble before the merger, which I want to get to. So how can solar be so hot yet the solar companies are having so much trouble?
Well, what you're seeing is that it's a new industry. I mean, the investment tax credit that really propelled solar by allowing it to be financed and more accessible to Americans is not even 15 years old at this point. And so anytime you take on entrenched incumbents like utilities, there's an unlevel playing field, and policy definitely is not the same for both. There's a predictable rate of return for utilities, and then the new entrants are consuming as much cash as they can to grow, and so which is no different than the tech sector or the life science sector. But this because it's something that people use every day, they see it, they need it on a 24/7 basis. This makes a lot of waves, and so. What is normal in the tech sector in terms of growing into your profitability is more challenging for new entrants in the electricity sector. And so, unfortunately, some of these companies that were on a very high growth rate didn't have the adequate financing to survive as standalone. But you'll see that they will become part of really the new electricity model of the future.
Okay, so that leads us to the merger of Tesla and SolarCity, which I just want to ask you. You're buddies with Elon Musk. How did he manage that whole thing, which was quite stressful and a lot of headlines around it and whatnot. So what's the inside story of how that all came through?
Well, the inside story, we'll have to wait for that book that I'm going to be writing someday, I'm afraid. But basically, people should not be surprised that this merger happened, and it's fulfilling its promise even in its early days, as is evidenced by Australia and Aliso Canyon. There's such a commonality between the battery expertise at Tesla and the solar expertise, and those two are now coming together for the reasons we just talked about. They're different cultures, they're different kinds of sales. I mean, selling a car is very different than selling electricity. But I think that the reason this happened is really because we need that combination to address 21st century electricity needs. We don't need more of the same model that worked very well in the 20th century, but is not really suited for what we're up against now.
Right. So before the election, I think around the time of the presidential debates, you and Fran Siegel wrote a joint letter to both candidates, sort of talking about the impact economy and where it might go. And I think you were trying to be nonpartisan and sort of portray it as something liberals like impact investing because it takes on social challenges and whatnot. Conservatives can like it because it's free market type solutions. Then we had the election. So where do we now stand? I think the president, there's news today that they're rolling out their climate policy soon. I think you know some of the directions they're taking. Where does impact go in this new environment?
Well, the good news is that impact is pretty nonpartisan, because as you mentioned, what's not to like about making great companies that your kids want to work for or you want to work for that make great financial returns but are also solving some of the largest problems of our generation? There's nothing partisan. That's not a blue issue. That's not a red issue. And so what we see, and since the election, I think you've seen a doubling down on impact. People are more excited than ever because if you don't like what's going on in Washington, if you think Washington is broken, then you can invest with your principles and not have any sacrifice. And that really is the key to it, not to have a sacrifice between what you'd like to see in terms of improvements in the world and the economy and diversity and climate, but also create the iconic new companies that our kids will work for.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So what do you think in the kind of energy, climate, renewables space? I mean, is there a now going to be a roadblock? Are the trends so powerful that it's inexorable?
Well, I don't think there's a roadblock because of what you said a few minutes ago. Whenever prices come down quickly and scale goes up, that's an unstoppable combination. And so if you were saying that solar and wind were way more expensive than fossil alternatives, that would be a push. But they're cheaper. I mean, they're becoming cheaper in many places, and they're at parity in most others. So anytime you have economics on your side, that really, no pun intended, trumps the partisanship nature.
There was maybe a bright spot coming out of the coming announcements. There might be a manned space mission to Mars, which might benefit one of your companies.
Well, could benefit the world. You're referring. I don't know anything more than what the Twitter storm that I saw that the president announced that NASA is going to be funded for manned space missions to Mars. And of course, that is one of the missions of SpaceX, which is one of our portfolio companies. So we're all about discovery and the role that mapping nanosatellites can play in understanding our own Earth. But if we really don't do a good job in dealing with climate, we will need a plan B. And so that might just be
We'll go live on Mars. if Mars is more habitable than Earth, we may be in trouble. I want to do two quick sections now. The first is the big cool ideas section. So venture capitalists and you leading among them, look out in the future, see the trends, see the disruptions, see the future. And so I want to take you through a few sectors that I know you've been looking at and tell us, sort of this may be the actionable part of it here. So Nancy funds investment tips or at least trend spotting of the future. You mentioned obviously the developing world off-grid and your company with off-grid electric.
It's just a huge opportunity. There are 1.3 billion people on this planet that don't have access to electricity. I mean, it's inconceivable in 2017 that so many people live that way, and it's so easy to fix without a huge carbon footprint, with distributed low-cost electricity that is clean, and all of the lighting and TVs, really giving people that aren't able to join the middle class for the simple reason they don't even have lights in their home to do their homework by. Their kids can't study adequately. Fix that, and all of a sudden you have a ticket to the middle class in the regions in the world really that are where all the population is growing. I mean, over half the population growth on this planet planet is going to be in Africa over the next 30 years. So if we don't create that vibrant economy and create access to electricity, we're going to have, you know, more problems down the road than we want.
I think that was one of your first non-U.S. investments. Does that signal sort of more of a global outlook now?
Well, it was our first non-U.S. headquartered company. Some of the team is actually based here because technology is such a important facet of the work in getting low-cost electricity to developing nations. We're taking it kind of baby steps. We're very convinced that this is going to be a great company, but we want to work with it a little more, learn what's different about investing in the developing world, and then kind of assess whether this is something that we want to do more of. There's certainly an entrepreneurial blossoming in we're getting deals from all over the world as a result of that OGE investment.
And then another one that sort of is a sort of signal of the future is this. It has to do with battery storage as almost a real estate play at some level, right?
We have a company called Advanced Microgrid Solutions, which is right here by the ballpark in San Francisco, run by a very talented woman, Susan Kennedy, who talk about career evolution. She used to be the chief of staff for Governor Schwarzenegger, and as part of that job, she developed a lot of the climate policies that we're now very proud to be implementing today. But what she saw is that, because she understands how utilities think, how corporations think, and the role of storage in being able to reshape the electricity load of an office park or a building so that you're drawing power from the most economic source. And that could be from your battery at a certain time, or it could be from your solar panels, or from the grid. There are all kinds of tariffs and charges that determine when it's best to use which power source. And at the same time, it allows you to manage the load on the overall grid better. So for a utility where you may have weak pockets of electricity in various substation areas, you can improve the functionality of the grid as you're making it more cost effective. This couldn't have been done even 5 years ago, and yet this will be routine in the next 10 to 15 years.
And there's big, I mean, you mentioned, I think, a couple of them, the Southern California Edison and whatnot. These are becoming big installations of batteries.
We have, I think SoCal Edison has two 40-megawatt contracts with this company. You're seeing Texas, which is a huge wind leader, buying into this architecture. Massachusetts, New York, California has led in this because of certain policies that created incentives for storage, but you're going to see this across the nation.
Now, it doesn't hurt that Advanced Microgrid also buys a bunch of Tesla batteries, right?
Well, it's that cluster, that regional cluster that helps.
Agriculture, that doesn't seem like, you know, amenable to the same kind of trends as the energy sector, the tech kind of trends, but there's now a vibrant ag tech world, and you guys are looking at that.
Absolutely, and really strong impact, and you know, $1 trillion market. I mean, we have to feed all the people on this planet, which is growing substantially, and we have to do it in a way that is more resource friendly and efficient, and in a way that allows farmers to prosper. And really, this is something that we really went after because we're used to the urban issues, the urban companies, Silicon Valley, but we did learn a lesson in this election that there's a whole group of people in our country that haven't benefited from some of the progress that we take for granted. And farmers have not had the access to things like big data and the ability to make better decisions based on crowdsourced data about their seeds or their fertilizer. And meanwhile, commodity prices on farms have gone down, and many farmers are eating into the equity of their farm just to stay afloat. And that's just not acceptable. That's not sustainable. Farmers are among our country's first entrepreneurs, when you think about it, and yet they just haven't been given the tools. They haven't been able to make decisions in a way that maximizes their profitability. And so what a company that we invested in called Farmers Business Network, which is located here but has most of its employees in the heartland, is really just crowdsourcing information from farmers that they collect anyway, but instead of a farmer making a decision based on his or her own farm data, now you get the wisdom of the crowd. You get a whole county or you get a whole region of a state, and it shows you where you rank, where your yield ranks compared to your neighbors. It's all anonymous, of course, but and why? You know, what you're doing that isn't really making you as much profit as you could get. And every, you know, every dollar matters, especially with the vagaries of weather and what we're seeing, the effects of climate change on farming. So this is this is a really important chapter in impact investing's growth, to realize that there are folks out there that don't live where we do, that aren't part of this bubble, that are very much in need of the benefits of rethinking their industry that kind of we take for granted. And this is going to be a huge return. I mean, this is a $1 trillion industry. Some of the leaders in this space, like John Deere, they're not even 20th century names. That company was formed in 1832 or 1837. Monsanto barely made it in the 21st century, founded in 1901. We need some 21st century agricultural giants, and we're creating them as we speak.
So you mentioned people sort of left out of the prosperity. There is, you know, in the impact investing world, you know, an emphasis on reaching and, frankly, making richer, you know, low-income people, a kind of economic inclusion. I know you've talked about, you know, just the sort of, you know, even the opportunities in all the people on food stamps. How does impact investing become relevant to, you know, the real sort of economic dislocation, that is driving some of the politics that we've been seeing?
Right. Well, we first saw this 11 years ago with Revolution Foods, because we saw that low-income children were eating very unhealthy lunches as part of their school lunch. And so the two gals that founded that company really set about to create nutritious, delicious lunches that kids would eat and replace all of the junk food that they were getting. And so that was a wake-up call for us that, yeah, there is a double standard here. It's what our kids in a middle-class environment eat is not the same, and the diseases are different. There's an epidemic of diabetes and obesity in these kinds of demographics. So the success of Revolution Foods, which now serves almost 2 million meals a week from zero back when we started, that really showed us that if you market to this population with products that improve their lives, you can make a big company. And so food stamps, we haven't invested in that space yet. There's a company called Propel in Brooklyn that's really going after that market, and the one of the founders is a former Facebook employee that just is developing apps that make that much easier. Even a company like The Muse, which is a career building company that we've invested in, founded by two women in New York City, that it's kind of a LinkedIn for the rest of us. It skews, while it is broadly popular, it skews toward minorities and women. And it's for those folks that really find it hard to get into the labor market because they don't have the skills. They don't know how to write a resume. They don't know the interview tricks that a lot of us get from our friends or our family or from schools that we're in. So there's just this kind of below the radar lack of access to tools that the middle class demographic really takes for granted, that we need to make more broadly accessible.
But how do you escape the pressures? Like you said, you know, the companies have to be immensely profitable in order to get big, but the direction of becoming profitable often is going for a higher income customer segment. So how do you without having a trade-off, how do you actually make a profitable company that actually can serve low-income people?
Well, there are two ways. And Revolution Foods, is which I just described, started from the get-go to go after that population and developed a way of serving lunch much more cheaply than the traditional cafeteria approach that schools have used for decades. So that's one way to do it, and you build a brand.
So tech-driven and
yeah,
sort of
smarter,
process engineering.
Smarter, faster, cheaper, better, that whole approach. And also develop a brand and go after, you know, be able to convince, you know, the San Francisco Unified School District that this is a better way. And that's a big account, and get a lot of those. The other way is more of the Tesla model or Juicero. I don't know if any of you know that company here in San Francisco, which is a no fuss, no mess juicer that allows you to have cold pressed juice in your home.
Sort of the Keurig of juices, right? Or something
yeah.
There's like a machine and it squeezes
it's a pouch of chopped up veggies and fruits, and it just kind of squeezes that pouch and out comes delicious fresh juice. So that like a Tesla Roadster or Model S, those start expensive. And all, you know, we get told all the time, oh, you know, these products, they're not accessible. But that's really a misnomer, because you start there, you sell the high-priced goods, and that allows you to plow that revenue back into scaling your manufacturing, improving your design, which drives down the price so that the next generation is accessible to a broader group of people. And we've seen that at Tesla. Obviously, the Model 3, 10 years later, will be a much more broadly accessible electric car for a mass market, which was not possible in the early days. Similarly, a company like Juicero will start with something that costs, you know, $695 and drive that down to that sweet spot in appliances, which is somewhere between $100 and $300.
And is that part of the intentionality that in addition to it possibly being a good business move, it's also a social goal to be able to be more accessible?
Absolutely. And we really do push back on folks when they, like everyone used to say, oh, well, Tesla is just a car for rich people. And that is just not the plan. That was not the plan from day one. It's a means to an end. You can't just arrive on the scene with a high-tech, very highly engineered product that is cost-reduced as well.
Okay, last sector, conservation, which is always a tough one, because how do you make preserving landscapes, you know, pay either the same or more than, you know, exploiting them or destroying them? So
yeah.
You have a cool idea, I think.
Yeah, we're kind of just in the process of investing in this company, so I won't be able to name it, but I can kind of tell you what you do. And it comes, it's the theme of say, Tesla and Juicero, where you have a really big problem, and you kind of attach a bright, shiny object to it, and, you know, either a Roadster or a Model S or a high-tech, beautiful juicer, as in the case of Juicero. So we have the problem that we need to conserve forest lands and natural lands for lots of reasons, which you all know about, but especially we can sequester more carbon through trees and so reduce our carbon load in the atmosphere, not just through solar but and renewables, but through actual natural means. But it's hard to make that a business. I mean, there's not a huge kind of profit opportunity there. And so what you do is you have to find something that needs improving in another sector that needs forests. So one of what this company that we're looking at is doing is saying, well, you know, kind of the funeral, the death industry is a little bit broken because it's not the best experience for people when they're most vulnerable. It doesn't have the user friendliness that we see in other industries, and it's also there are cemeteries are not really going to be viable to be built in urban areas anymore. No one wants them, and they're not a good use of urban space. And so what if, and also people are moving away from the traditional burial to cremation. I mean, some estimates say that will be 70% of burials will be through cremation over the next few decades. And so what if instead of the traditional experience, which we all know about, that is not fulfilling, what if you were able to purchase land that was and keep it in perpetuity for as a forest, and then be able to allow your loved ones' remains to be under a beautiful redwood or a oak or whatever it is that moves you or that is near where you live, and have that special place be for your loved ones forever, and sort of completely redefine the whole burial and death experience in a positive way. And then the frosting on the cake is that you're putting more conservation into our economy by protecting these lands forever.
So you'd go visit the tree, not the bench or the tombstone.
Yeah, you'd have your own special place, and it would be a beautiful place. Yeah. And so who thinks of these things? I mean, this is what the beauty of entrepreneurship is. I mean, I certainly would never have thought of that. And yet it responds to a growing desire that folks have to turn what is, you know, often a fragile and sad time into one where you're at one with nature and make it beautiful and lasting.
I guess start lining up and thinking of your questions. The mic is here, is that right? So make your way over there if you want to ask a question. So now we're going to get to the very quick lightning round where I tell you a word and you riff quickly off the top of your mind, just very shortly. So, subsidy.
Subsidies. Double standard. We all know that energy subsidies for oil and gas in 1917 and around then, and then nuclear subsidies in the mid-century, were pivotal in helping the 20th century be as economically vibrant as it was, and yet those are the gifts that keep on giving. Those subsidies are still on the books while people criticize the incentives that renewables have had for less than 15 years. So it's a proven technique that has worked in traditional energy, and we should accept its role in the 21st century transition to a clean energy economy.
Bubble.
Timing is everything. It's a part of our lives, whether an impact investor or any investor, that you really do need to understand that there is a moment for certain kinds of stories and make sure that your investment appetite is one that is both advantaged by that, but also protect yourself from the inevitable burst.
There was an old New Yorker cartoon that said, "Dear Lord, just give me one more bubble."
and by the way, I think that these trends are not bubbles. I mean, because we've got a whole century ahead of us where we've got to redefine it. Basically everything we did in the 20th century, and that's going to take us out several decades.
SDGs. Sustainable Development Goals.
Ah, okay, like the UN.
As in?
These, useful, a little too abstract.
Okay.
Because they're hard to enforce.
Got it. 2 degrees.
Achievable.
Institutional, as in big pension and sovereign wealth and institutional investors and
inevitable.
And impact.
Inevitable that the big institutions, sovereign wealth funds, endowments, pensions will move to more impact investing because it's good for their constituencies and it's good for society.
Billionaires.
Billionaires and impact. Well, we've already created a few, and there will be many more created. And that's important because that's what so many people care about when it comes to business and entrepreneurship. I mean, we wish it were just about the mission, but let's face it, the financial reward is one that drives more people into this field.
Great. And then the last one is Alpha, as in perhaps like Impact Alpha.
An awesome firm.
All right, let's have some questions.
Hey, Nancy, thanks for coming tonight. My name is Carlo, six-time entrepreneur, two in the impact space. My question is, how do we get more San Franciscan entrepreneurs going into the social entrepreneurship path?
Well, I think that, thank you, Carlos. That's a question we ask ourselves quite a bit. I would say that the early returns are encouraging because what I was saying earlier, that the companies that are in San Francisco are all in for impact, and so they hire with those kinds of values in mind, and then as people leave those companies and start their own, then you start the next generation. But I think we could benefit from more education, more in terms of our political leaders, have them understand how this can transform communities, really focusing on some of the economic development benefits of impact investing, I think is the way to get at a city level more dollars and more programs associated with fostering impact investing and entrepreneurship.
Thank you.
Thanks, Manu Kurdian. Hard act to follow. It's the first time an entrepreneur. So where do you source your deals from, and what kind of deals do you know would likely surface in your mind space, and what stage of investments do you look at?
We get deals from all over. I'm sure we'll get some interesting deals from tonight's discussion. We have our own networks of entrepreneurs we've worked with, lawyers, accountants, people in companies that have we've backed before. So part of it is that, but in impact investing, of course, you want to broaden the scope. And so we do a lot of speaking at public forums, at universities. We work with incubators. So we have inbound, and then we generate our own deal flow as well. And in terms of stage, we are not stage agnostic, but we are open to anything from a seed investment, which we're doing as we speak, to some later stage, more mature investments, as long as they're private.
Thank you.
Hi, Luke Hallbaker with Monitor Deloitte. Was heartened to hear you talk about conservation and intrigued by the example that you brought forward. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about your approach to conservation and to the conservation finance market, especially since it is so nascent and has been less capitalized on, I think, by VC firms and by traditional tech companies or tech startups.
Well, and that's why we're so excited about this company that attaches a whole kind of business that needs upgrading to conservation, because it is hard from a venture capital perspective to make the kinds of returns protecting forests, protecting wetlands. So far we haven't found a model, a standalone model to do that. However, the good news is that there are firms out there that do deal with real assets, that look at better ways of sustainable forestry creation, that look at wetlands protection. So, and those are a little kind of more akin to real estate investments than to venture capital.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hello, Michelle Buckles. Given that you're a venture capital firm, how can we widen the opportunities for different types of interested parties in impact investing, from real retail investors to institutional investors? How can we create more of a pipeline for a wider variety of people?
Well, good question. And we play, the role that a venture capitalist plays is hopefully to create more investable public companies when they go public. And when we started, there were hardly any clean tech public companies. And now we have, you know, we have a whole category there that people make ETFs around and such. So that's our role. But for others, there are green bonds, there are solar bonds, there are credit unions and cash products where you're able to monitor the way that your short-term investing is done, make sure that it's according to your beliefs. There are public equities, all kinds of screening products now. So it's in international microfinance. There is a whole array of risk-reward products out there. And so I think that will appeal increasingly to both the retail and the institutional. So I think it's...
But it's safe to say that the retail end of impact investing has been relatively underdeveloped compared to, say, accredited investors who can get into to bigger deals, right?
Yes, but I think that's changing.
Yeah.
Hi, Nancy. My name's Nancy as well. I come from the public equity ESG side, and I think over time that side has been making good strides on kind of measuring environmental, social, governance criteria and SASB and other UNPRI within impact investing, also because the capital's private. There's less transparency on what impact there is. What kind of requirements do you have, and maybe have you seen your peers have, around startups having some kind of impact metrics and how much guidance you provide on telling them what kind of impact metrics they should be measuring and kind of helping them and things like that?
It's a very good question, and it's one that people are talking about in our field quite a bit. We had the advantage when we started. The Ford Foundation was really the first investor we had, and that was the good news. The challenging news was that they wanted us to measure absolutely everything. And every one of our companies, how many employees, what kind, where did they live, what did they eat, it was maybe not what they ate, but it was just overwhelming. And so we negotiated over 6 months to develop metrics that really pretty much we still use today. We pay attention, and this is, the important thing is that you have an intentionality, as I said, and that you measure. And not everyone should have the same metrics. We cared from the get-go about place. We wanted those jobs to go into low-income neighborhoods. So we count jobs, we look at zip codes, we look at census tracts. We also care about sustainability, we care about diversity, we care about workforce practices and benefits, and we care about policy. We're very involved in linking our companies to policy and vice versa. And so we have both quantitative metrics as well as a narrative of things that are hard to measure in a number, and we report on that to our investors. And we've learned a whole lot from that over the years. And so what we believe is it's far too young a field and diverse a field to have a cookie-cutter approach. It's not a one-size-fits-all. But people should decide what are they trying to accomplish and develop their own metrics around that. And now there are some standards out there that help people figure that out.
What would you say is like the standard that you look to?
Well, our metrics preceded, there's things called the ISIS and...
IRIS.
I'm sorry, ISIS. What a Freudian slip. We feel that our metrics for kind of what we do are more robust. If there are metrics that come around that we think are better than ours, we will switch someday. But so far that hasn't happened.
Hi, Nancy. My name is Gabriel Ayala, and my question is if you could give more detail. I think you answered a little bit in the lightning round, but the prevalence of impact investing as an asset class among investors and kind of detail what investors today who invest with you are looking for versus investors before. Because in my mind, if you give people the choice between, hey, you can make some money or you can make some money and do well, I would hope that most people choose the latter. So why don't people choose that if, as we've mentioned in the beginning, there isn't really a trade-off anymore between returns and doing well in the community?
Well, the good news is that the large institutional investors are coming into the space. I mean, here in San Francisco, TPG is raising an impact fund. In Boston, Bain Capital has an impact fund. Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch. I mean, you go through any Wall Street house, they all at Bank of the West, of our host tonight. Of course, this is mainstream, and it's driven both by availability of product, but also the client. The client says just what you said. Gee, if I can make money and make the world a better place, you know, what's not to like about that? So that's happening. It doesn't happen overnight, and the talent within financial institutions has to kind of be trained and to understand this and to really protect the financial returns as we move toward this kind of investing. It is happening. There is a bias still among, you know, a small group of people that there is a sacrifice, but the more we have examples of winners on both sides, that will fade away.
Hi, Nancy. I'm Michael. You mentioned at the beginning of your talk how you work closely with a governmental organization, a local governmental organization. Could you talk more about that, or perhaps an anecdote from one of your portfolio companies, and how you built that relationship and what you think the ideal dynamic is between an impact company and local government?
It's not the glamorous kind of meet your senator for cocktails kind of thing. It's you know, it's really going into City Hall and finding the person that does the permitting, and you know, that person probably doesn't even have a window in the office necessarily. and that's where some of the biggest gains are made. From our early days, we helped SolarCity in the early days when there were no trained solar workers. We developed training programs with them and got some financing that allowed community colleges in the region to start teaching classes on solar installation. Revolution Foods, we've done a lot of things with them, but the workers there don't necessarily have a tradition of having bank accounts or lots of information about how to manage their finances. And so we helped with financial literacy. We've developed a program for debit cards so that they can avoid putting their salary into the hands of payday lenders. So we've also helped with one of the things we did at Rev Foods was to create a English as a second language program for some of the workers there that were having trouble communicating and not perhaps advancing as much as they would like. And so we found out that in Alameda County, if you can get free adult education classes in English if you have a certain amount of people. So that was something that we did. It just goes on and on. We're working with the California legislature now on this whole idea of unlocking data and making it more transparent as we move toward a distributed clean economy. We want to move beyond having just that information be the province of utilities to unlock innovation by having, you know, the Googles and the Apples of the world look at this data and use it, and entrepreneurs develop companies around it. And so that started as a sort of a local effort, and now we're moving up to the state legislature.
Thank you.
I think we have time for like two more questions, so you folks at the end should have lined up earlier.
But we can talk afterwards as well.
I'm wondering if you have any advice to someone that doesn't have a super strong finance background but really wants to get more involved in the impact investing space.
Right. Well, I was an anthropology major, so I feel I use that degree every day, really, in terms of understanding subcultures and traditions and how those affect innovation and change. So a lot of what we do involves the rudimentary financial skills, but it's so much more than that. And so if you have a passion for a particular area, be it diversity or climate change, and you develop an expertise around that, the finance stuff is actually not that difficult to learn. It's having that more multidimensional understanding of how to affect change and what are the forces both supporting and thwarting that. And so it really has to do with more of the human interaction issues as well as finance. And if you feel that finance is something that you're really sorely missing, then I would, you know, just, you don't have to get an MBA unless you really want to. You can take classes and kind of get enough of the lexicon and the knowledge to get you on your way.
Or you could become a journalist.
I like that. I'm Bobby Fishkin. I'm a social entrepreneur. I wanted to ask, so in our community of social entrepreneurs in the Bay Area, with individual social enterprise often tries to take on the whole challenge of some epic, giant, global challenge. And I do want to scale the social enterprise sector to the scale of the problems, but in order for them to individually have additionality or generate whole outcomes, they often need to collaborate either with supply chain or distribution chain. And this brings up that it's often mutually reinforcing social innovations that create long-term outcomes, whether NVU or the Harlem Children's Zone or other examples of a portfolio of social innovations that address a wicked problem from multiple dimensions. And I wanted to ask, how do y'all think about wicked problems in the context of DBL?
Well, the wickeder the better, because those are the big problems lead to big markets. I mean, I can't think of a more wicked problem than 1.3 billion people on this planet not having access to electricity. And yet, through a series of innovations and financial innovation, in addition to technical progress, we're able to make a dent on that, you know, one neighborhood at a time. I think you have to be incremental in terms of realizing that you can't solve it overnight, but you've got to be revolutionary in understanding that without disrupting what has been, you'll never get to the place you want to be.
Thank you.
So now it's an informed tradition to ask every speaker one question. What is your 60-second idea to change the world? So, Nancy, the clock is running.
Well, that's obvious, isn't it? To have a firm like DBL in every town and rural neighborhood across the country and the world. Not us, DBL, but to have impact investing become mainstream investing and to infuse every investment decision with the not just the financial return, but how is it going to improve climate, the world, poverty, diversity, social opportunity. And in that way, we really get to not just as we're I was a securities analyst early in my career, get analysts not just to look at net profit, but net purpose.
Well, thank you, Nancy, and let's thank Nancy. And
thank you.
And let's thank the Commonwealth Club as well, and also Bank of the West for hosting us.